It's Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Previously.
No, because it's very frustrating to not have an answer. Some people feel like they could deal with the consequences better if they just knew why.
We're not asking the patient, do you like your periods? We're just trying to figure out what are they like? In other words, are they regular? There's a big difference between every 25 days and every 35 days.
This is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Well, hi, Austin. This is Dr. Kalen Silverberg, and joining me today is Dr. Natalie Berger, and we are physicians from the Texas Fertility Center in Austin. Today is June 26th, and again, we're live at 12:06 in the afternoon on Saturday, a hot Saturday, I might add. We are looking forward to speaking with you today. We're going to be happy to take your calls. Just to go over the call-in number again, it's 390-1370 if you have any questions for us today. Natalie, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well, but it's a truly hot day here, so I'm very much enjoying the air conditioning here in the studio.
I know, it's so nice in here, and I love that Dolby. I got to tell you guys, I love that Dolby thing that you play at the introduction of the show. That's just kind of cool. It's like in the movies. We have got so much to talk about today, and I know that we've got an information-packed show, but a couple things I wanted to tell our listeners about today because we've had a lot of questions from our patients. We have debuted a brand-new website, which is www.txfertility.com. You can link to that either through the 1370 Talk Radio website, or you can go to that directly. And we've added some really cool features this week, as you know.
Yeah, and actually it's really exciting because not only is our website available in standard English, but for those of y'all who have family or friends who are not native English speakers, we can now translate our website into Hindi, Vietnamese, and Spanish.
And then Mandarin is going to be coming up this week as well.
Which is wild. So, and this is actually not just a, brief little website we have. It is jam-packed full of information.
I know. I think most websites are, 8 to 12 pages, and ours, I think, is 170 pages. And it's just full of everything from video and audio and tours of the lab and all kinds of information about everything from embryo grading to the fertility evaluation, part of which we're going to talk about today.
So even if you are just looking for more fertility information, this is not something that, is obligating you to seek our services. But if you're simply looking for more information, especially, again, if you are frustrated by the fact that you're not able to find it in a language you can understand, we are having more options now.
Right. And the other thing is we found out this week that we actually have some listeners from outside the Austin area. We have listeners from around the state of Texas who are actually, I guess, listening on the web. And the bottom line is that even if they just want a second opinion or they want to find some other information about diagnoses they've been given, they can go to our site. It's actually called an authority site. And so there's so much information there, and we provide links. We provide research studies that we're doing, published papers or stuff that we've already done, papers we've already published. But we're excited about that. And we also have another big announcement, don't we?
Yes. We actually just added our fifth provider to our practice. Her name is Rinku Mehta. She actually did her training in Galveston, I think, for medical school and residency.
Right.
Then did her fellowship on the West Coast at UCSD. And more recently was in the Dallas-Frisco area and has now joined us in Austin. She's super nice. We are super excited to have her. And so if you want more information about her, there actually is a little bit more information on her website as well, too, on the front page there.
So. Sure. In fact, I met her several years ago. In fact, I was giving a talk in San Francisco, and she came up to me and she said, "Hey, we really want to come back to Texas. Is there, any opportunity with your group?" And I said, "Oh, my gosh," at the time, there just wasn't, because we'd been lucky enough to find you. And so we were so happy to bring you on board. And then we've just maintained contact with her, but she went to Dallas, and she had a very, very successful practice in Dallas, but they really wanted to come back to the Central Texas area, both her and her husband, and we were so excited to be able to recruit her, and she actually officially starts on Monday, and even though our main office is on Mopac, just south of Far West, she is actually going to be almost full-time in our Round Rock office. So you're going to be in our Round Rock office, and she's going to be in our Round Rock office, and Thomas and Lisa and I are going to kind of rotate in and out of that office. And I think our listeners are going to understand also that we're actively looking for some office space in South Austin to try and even expand the practice to so many of our patients who are in the Circle C area.
Yeah, it's an exciting time for sure. So keep listening to us.
Well, great. Well, listen, I was out of town last week, and I didn't even get a chance to catch the show. I heard kind of bits and pieces about what you guys were doing, but kind of bring us up to speed. Where'd you guys leave off, and what do you want to talk about today?
Well, last week we talked a little bit more about the effect that substance abuse can have on fertility, both for men and women. And then we started segueing into what are important details about your history and how they affect fertility. You're realizing that a lot of women don't know quite what details about their menstrual history is important. Sometimes people feel like they are giving too much information. So we went over that, or started a little bit of that last week, and we mostly touched on menstrual periods and sexually transmitted infections. And so today what I thought we'd do is just go over a little bit more of the stuff that's pertinent, just so you guys know, you know, when we're asking questions, if you see us for a visit or so, why we're asking it. We're not trying to probe. Certainly these are very personal questions, and we're not trying to make you uncomfortable. We're not trying to make your husband uncomfortable. But really, they do have a very important bearing on the kinds of evaluations and treatments that we would consider. Mm-hmm. So we want to talk a little bit more about this. And then, so first off, in terms of things, again, be aware that we have probably seen it all, even though you've had very personal experiences. You may be super embarrassed to discuss, you know, episode X or discharge Y or whatever.
Right.
It is very normal to us. This is what we do all the time, and we have seen it all before.
So
do not or heard it.
Many times.
So it's hard to shock us at this point. But feel free to be as open as you can. We realize also there are scenarios where, like, we'll have couples where one partner will have an issue and may not have revealed it to the other partner, and will feel more comfortable actually talking to the physician in private. So we've certainly had those scenarios before.
And we do that too, right? I mean, you know, if a woman has something that she wants to tell us and she doesn't want her partner there, then, you know, we're more than happy to participate in that, or we're happy to talk to the guys. And, you know, there are opportunities during the course of a visit for either the woman or the man to talk to us privately.
Yeah. And it's true, especially as comes up with prior history infections, sometimes with a history of pregnancy termination, or just other details that they just don't feel comfortable talking to a partner about. Ideally, it'd be nice to have everyone, you know, talking about it openly, but certainly we appreciate and respect the partner's wishes. So we will certainly keep your information confidential if you desire.
But the big deal is we need to know it.
Right.
Right. It's not, I tell my patients all the time, this is not keep away. I mean, this is, I don't want to keep information away from the physician, because we're going to potentially treat you very differently if you've never been pregnant, or if you got pregnant very easily, but with a different partner.
Right. And actually, you know, there can be some positives in terms of having a past pregnancy, even if it was terminators, though. I mean, that in and of itself may give you a little bit better odds of succeeding with fertility treatment with a current partner. And especially if you've had any kind of procedure to the uterus in the past, like a termination, it's important for us to know, because it may perk up our ears in terms of the possibility of things like uterine scarring and such. So, yes, we are not trying to probe for unnecessary, you know, trying to dig out the skeletons in your closet for no good reason. There are very good reasons why we're asking you some of the questions that we're asking you. And sometimes you may feel there's something that we're not asking you that may be relevant. And again, feel free to fill us in, whether, you know, in front of your partner or confidentially, just to make sure that there's no issue with fertility.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it's just so important, and we've got to have honesty, and we've got to know exactly where we're coming from. So along those lines, I mean, what types of questions do you ask your patients when they come in for a first visit?
Well, in terms of, you know, the infertility evaluation, certainly if the couple has undergone any kind of evaluation in the past with like a prior program or with an OBGYN, it's true that that can, you know, clue us into what's already been tried. And if so, what dosages, you know, were used, and are we likely to be successful if we try the same dosage, or would we really need to be looking at something else? So certainly a past history of any kind of evaluation and treatment is critical. And as much information as you have about that is great. Some folks will come in with photocopies of their records. Other times, you know, they'll be able to contact the clinic to get records sent to us. But it's really helpful to have details about any kind of prior evaluations and treatments.
Sure. We need to know all that information. But just specifically when we were talking about, I mean, you know, for example, past sexual history, when you're going to mm-hmm. talk to your patients, I mean, it's important to know any previous pregnancies, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to know what the outcome was of the pregnancy. Did you deliver at term? In other words, did you go to 37, 40, 42 weeks, approximately 9 months of pregnancy? What if they delivered preterm? I mean, you know, there's some potential very important issues. For example, I saw a lady this past week, and she delivered at 32 weeks. So she delivered about 2 months early. The baby was breech. So the baby was coming down instead of head first, it was coming down bottom first. And she had preterm labor before that. So she was actually hospitalized once or twice before that. Mm-hmm. And it turns out after they deliver the baby, what do you think they find?
Well, I'm going to guess a uterine septum. That's or something.
That's exactly right.
She had a uterine abnormality.
Exactly right. She had a malformation of her uterus. So when she was a fetus in her mother's uterus, her uterus didn't form properly. And so we know that sometimes that adversely affects the chance for pregnancy. So we know a lot of couples who have a uterine septum, or when the female partner has a uterine septum, they may have difficulty conceiving to begin with. But that same disease, that same septum, is also associated with problems later on in pregnancy, like preterm labor, like preterm delivery, like the fact that she needs a C-section because the baby's coming down bottom first. And so therefore, it totally changed the approach to the evaluation.
Right. And it's true. Sometimes people will say, gosh, I've had 10 gazillion ultrasounds from my OBGYN. I was told everything was fine. I was never told I had a uterine abnormality. And it's true that we look at things a little bit differently. Even people who've had this thing called the X-ray dye test or hysterosalpingogram, which is a dye test that helps us to tell more about the contour of the inside of the uterus. Sometimes folks will have a, quote, normal evaluation per the radiology team. But when we look at it a little bit closer, and especially when we do our own ultrasound, we realize there's actually an abnormality. So having a previous test, done by a radiologist or OBGYN, saying your uterus is normal, doesn't necessarily always mean that there isn't a finding there.
Well, you have to understand, and I'm sure patients understand this when they think about it, but when they go to a radiologist to get an HSG done, I mean, how many HSGs does a typical radiologist do in a week compared to how many chest X-rays or how many CT scans or, and radiologists are so highly specialized now. I mean, in the old days, there was a radiologist who did everything.
Yeah.
And now with so many more, so many more tests now, you have radiologists who special in just MRI, and then they specialize in, the neurologic aspects of an MRI. So it's not really fair to expect the radiologist to do everything. And that's why we don't just want to see the report from the radiologist. We actually look at all the films ourselves.
Right.
But back to pregnancy for a minute. There's four basic categories of pregnancy outcomes that we look at. We look at term deliveries. Mm-hmm. We look at preterm deliveries. We look at pregnancies that are lost before 20 weeks. And then we look at living children. It's, the TPAL thing. So, we talked briefly about premature issues and problems that can cause prematurity, like a septum. But it's also important to know about pregnancies that end before that.
Right, because there is a slightly different evaluation that we consider for a case where a woman has lost two or more, and especially three or more pregnancies. And in this scenario, this would be considered recurrent miscarriage or repeated pregnancy loss. Though there is a lot of overlap with the infertility evaluation, there are certainly multiple tests that we'd consider above and beyond a standard fertility evaluation. So this would actually significantly change, how we approach things. And people sometimes think, I don't have a fertility problem. I just have a problem maintaining my pregnancy. Well, we actually deal with both sets of scenarios, not only people who are not able to achieve pregnancy period, but also people who have difficulty carrying the pregnancy or having pregnancies go beyond 7, 8, 10 weeks or so.
Right. And I mean, the goal is a successful, healthy outcome, a healthy baby, right? Patients don't come in the door saying, hey, gee, what's the chance that I'm going to have a positive pregnancy test? They want to know what the chances they're going to have a healthy baby.
Right, right. So, it's true. In terms of the obstetric stuff, it's a very important thing for us to know a lot of information about any kind of previous OB history. And again, if you're not comfortable disclosing whatever information in front of your partner, please, please, please let us know, privately or confidentially or so, because it is such a critical thing when we're looking at the evaluation and treatment.
And there's so many other possible outcomes as well. I mean, do you consider a miscarriage the same as you would consider a tubal pregnancy, an ectopic pregnancy?
No, because, then our ears start perking up in terms of issues of tubal damage or tubal issues. And yes, so we start thinking maybe different kinds of treatments may be more appropriate in these ladies.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're gonna have to take a break here. We're coming up against a break, but let's pick up where we left off here, talking about tubal pregnancies and pregnancy losses when we come back after the break. Again, this is Beyond the Birds and the Bees. Dr. Natalie Berger, Dr. Kaylin Silverberg, we'd love to take questions from you if you want to call us at 390-1370, and we'll be back right after the break. Come back and join us.
It may roll. Give it a spin. See if you can somehow factor in.
Talk Radio, 1370 AM.
Some of the best stories are the ones you've never heard until...
Welcome back to Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Hey, this is Natalie Berger. I'm here with Kaylin Silverberg. Again, we are bringing you another edition of Beyond the Birds and Bees. And today what we're talking about again is the stuff in your past and how relevant is it to your fertility evaluation and treatment. And what we had, and before we start talking about it, let me again remind you guys the call-in number. For anybody who has any questions, our number is 390-1370. It's Talk Radio 1370 AM.
And also, if I can interrupt for 1 second, Snoop came in during the break and told us that he is actually posting some relevant content, things that we're talking about now. So if you are sitting in front of a computer, if you can go to talk1370.com, you'll be able to pick up on some information that we're putting up on the web, talking about or dealing with some of the things that we're talking about in the show today and some of the information that we've talked about in previous shows. Also, if we can direct you to our website, which is www.txfertility.com. And again, lots of relevant information there. And if you missed the first part of the show, we were talking about the fact Natalie introduced the concept that we now have a translator on there. So if you go up to the top of the website, you can hit a button and you can translate the site into Hindi, Spanish, Vietnamese, and coming this week, you'll be able to translate it into Mandarin as well. And the good news is you'll be able to pick up all the information you need from the website. The bad news is we don't want you coming into the office thinking that we've got three people who are going to be able to speak fluent Mandarin with you, because it isn't going to happen, not at this point.
Working on it. So basically, we had been talking before we left about obstetric history and what are the important details about that. And we were briefly talking about a history of tubal or ectopic pregnancy and how that can be important in terms of the evaluation and treatment of infertility.
Right. So when I'm sitting there talking to a couple and I hear that she's had two previous ectopic pregnancies, I mean, the first thing I'm thinking about is, okay, we need to evaluate her fallopian tubes, because for those of you who are not aware, a tubal pregnancy, when a woman ovulates, the egg comes out of the ovary and it's picked up by the fallopian tube. The couple has intercourse. The sperm go from the vagina through the cervix into the uterus, out into the tube, and actually fertilization occurs in the fallopian tube. So as a couple of my patients over the years have eloquently said, well, you know, all pregnancies start off as tubal pregnancies, don't they? And kind of that's true, because fertilization occurs in the fallopian tube. But then the good news is that pregnancies migrate down the tube into the uterus where they attach. The problem here occurs when that doesn't happen. So when an embryo starts to develop, but it decides it's just going to set up camp in the fallopian tube as opposed to migrating down into the uterus. And Natalie, why is that an issue? Why is that a problem?
Well, we know in those scenarios, we suspect that there's something about the inside of the fallopian tube that's not allowing the fertilized egg to make its way into the uterus. And it's true that even if someone has had that history on one side, even if they've had, for instance, two tubal pregnancies, both on the left side, even may have had that fallopian tube actually removed by their OBGYN or other provider, and may feel like, oh gosh, I have, you know, another perfectly fine fallopian tube. Well, to us, we're thinking possibly that that other fallopian tube may still be not, you know, so perfect and may be affected by whatever caused problems in the other fallopian tube to begin with.
Sure.
So, yes, we will, you know, typically still consider looking at both fallopian tubes, the history of tubal pregnancy. We do recognize the fact that certainly a person who's had a tubal pregnancy, even if their fallopian tubes appear open on testing, does have a higher chance of having a repeat tubal pregnancy in the future.
No, it happens so frequently because patients say, well, you know, my left tube was a problem, but, you know, the good news is they took my left tube out and my right tube should work fine, shouldn't it? And
right.
The problem is that infections, you know, gonorrhea, chlamydia, a ruptured appendix, stuff like that, they're equal opportunity offenders.
Right.
So they don't just go for that left fallopian tube and say, well, you know what, we'll damage this one until it can't be damaged anymore, and we'll leave the other tube alone. It just doesn't work that way.
And people come and say, you guys are gods, right? You can fix the fallopian tube. And the fallopian tube is a fairly delicate organ, so to speak. It, you know, the uterus can handle a whole lot. You can, you know, it can blow up 40-week size pregnancy, shrink back down. You can cut into it multiple times. It can heal. It's very hardy as an organ. Fallopian tubes, not so much. So, yes, there is such a thing as fallopian tube surgery, and there are some scenarios where we can help improve the fallopian tube. But once damage has occurred, there is no way to completely restore the fallopian tube to a normal position.
Right. And that tube is about as big around as a piece of uncooked angel hair pasta. I mean, that lumen of that tube, the cavity of the tube itself, is just not very big. And so whereas the uterus is a real thick-walled organ, when a pregnancy attaches to the uterus can stretch, as you said. I mean, it can blow up, I guess. I mean,
yeah, it's a muscular, like term, hardy, but, you know, it can do it all. Yeah. It can have multiple babies sometime. I mean, it can do so much. But the fallopian tubes are like, I think, I don't know, the ear. You know, you can't do so much to the middle ear, inner ear. It's a very delicate area. And once there is damage that occurs, it really is difficult for it to, you know, resume normal function. Sometimes you can. It's not like it's a, you know, all bets are off. But it's definitely something you have to be aware of in the future, that you have a higher risk in the future of that happening.
Sure. I mean, the risk of a tubal pregnancy in general is what, like one in 80 or so pregnancies?
Yeah, it's fairly uncommon. But then once you have one, then your odds go up, you know, much higher with the future pregnancies.
Yeah, it goes up to about 20% for a second pregnancy. So it really is a problem. And, you know, we try and save the tubes. I mean, that's what we do as fertility surgeons. We try and save all the organs. So save the ovaries, save the uterus for sure. But the bottom line is that those tubes can still be damaged. And if they're damaged, there's still hope, because we can either try and improve the tube surgically, or if need be, we can bypass the tube and talk about in vitro fertilization. And I know we're going to focus on that probably in the next few weeks. But let's get back to a couple of questions that we got in the off week or during the week before the show. Issues about sexual practices, frequency of intercourse, things like that. What do you tell your couples as far as what's the optimal frequency or suggested frequency for intercourse when they're trying to conceive?
I would typically say that in a person who has a normal sperm count, having intercourse every other day during the fertile window, which I think that you had actually brought up in the first show, you have a pretty neat way of actually describing people easily sort of when their fertile window is. So we know that, let's say a woman has 28-day cycles. We think that in general, women tend to ovulate about 14 days from, you know, before the start of the next period. So a person with 28-day cycles probably ovulates around day 14. Well, it's not unreasonable to have sex a few days earlier. So I think you had actually mentioned, take the average menstrual cycle length, subtract 17,
yeah,
and then for that next week, have sex every other day.
Yeah.
Now, so that's a very simple, obviously no-cost way of timing intercourse. It does depend upon having some regularity of a period. So certainly if someone has, like, you know, 21 to 35-day periods, that's a little bit more sketchy in terms of using
It's a little more of a challenge, right?
Yeah. And it's true that ovulation kits can provide a little bit more information, especially if people are trying to really hone in on when to have intercourse. But for a person with regular cycles who doesn't want to touch an ovulation kit initially, taking your regular menstrual cycle length, subtracting 17, starting on that cycle day, and then having sex every other day for about a week should really cover you in terms of...
It should. Although I'll tell my patients that, you know, if you've got a range, so for example, your cycles are 26 to 32 days, take the shorter end of that range.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's 26 to 32 days, take 26, subtract 17, you've got 9. It is 9, right?
Yeah.
It's 9. And start having sex every other day on day 9. So day 9, 11, 13, 15, 17. And, you know, it's unfortunate the way we talk about it. It makes it sound like it's work. It shouldn't be work. It shouldn't be work. It should still be fun. It should still be enjoyable as much as possible. But you know what? If you're coming home from work and you're both exhausted and you had a meeting after work and, you know, you don't get home until 10 o'clock, 10:30 and your husband's been there for a couple hours, it doesn't have to be the greatest experience on the planet every single time. So sometimes you just need to get the job done, get the sperm there. And, you know, it'll be better again a couple of days later, but it's very important. And the reason that we suggest every other day as opposed to every day or two or three times a day or whatever is because guys have to rebuild their sperm count. And after the break, I know we're going to come up against a break in a little bit, but after the break, we're going to talk a little bit more about the male evaluation and kind of the male history.
Mm-hmm.
But guys have got to rebuild their sperm counts. They've got to replenish them. So, and again, we'll focus more on this in a little bit, but sex every other day appears to be okay if people have pretty regular sperm counts.
Right. And again, if you want to have a little bit more focus in terms of the few days that are the best, you know, consider using an ovulation kit. But then again, if your cycles are very irregular, you really need to talk to your OBGYN or fertility provider about a better way of ovulating more regularly. And it's true that a lot of people, you know, ask us a lot of questions about sex. And certainly one thing that comes up super, super commonly is what positions are the best for sex? And basically, any position that you can get sperm in the vagina that works for you is fine. So
sure.
There is not a magic position. There is not a, you know.
Well, there could be a magic position.
Well, from for some.
From a sex or from a pregnancy perspective, there's probably no magic position.
Yeah, and it's true. So, you know, do what makes you feel good. And we talked a little bit in a few shows past about the fact that, you know, laying down for a few minutes after intercourse is probably not a bad idea. But
so what's a few minutes? I mean, how long do you want people to lay there for
minutes.
An hour?
Like,
you want to lay there
know,
for...
10 minutes is a very reasonable time if you just wanted to give some time for the sperm in the vagina to start traveling into the cervix and the uterus. But after you get up, that fluid that comes out may contain some sperm, but those are no more good sperm anymore. The good sperm have already left the you know place, have already started going up into the cervix and the uterus and the fallopian tubes. It is totally normal and expected to have fluid coming out of the vagina after you get up after intercourse.
Right.
And because people will think, oh my goodness, I'm doing something wrong. There's fluid coming out. You know, I have to like hike my hips up in the air, you know, 180 degrees. But it's actually totally expected. That fluid is semen. And the sperm are inside the semen, and the good sperm within minutes are already exiting the vagina into the cervix and into the uterus and fallopian tubes. So any of the dead or poorly moving sperm that are still left in the semen are not really going to be doing anything anyways.
Right, right. And so, you know, all you really need to do is lay still just long enough to let the sperm do their job and get up inside the cervix, because once they latch onto that cervical mucus, they're going to travel up into the uterus, and then they're going to travel out, and, you know, they'll be in good shape. So... So I think we've addressed that issue because there's lots of myths. I mean, there are myths about, well, what happens if my uterus is tilted backwards?
Oh, my goodness. So common.
You know, I saw my OB-GYN, and my OB-GYN said to me, hey, my uterus is tilted backwards. And so what does that mean? I mean, does that mean I should be on top? Does that mean I should be on bottom? Should, you know, somebody be in front of me or behind me or wherever? I mean, you know.
It can get pretty involved.
All those questions come up. And so the bottom line is there's really no good study that's shown that it really makes much of a difference, right? I mean, in the old days, you know, you used to want the cervix to be in a position so that it would kind of be close to where the pool of semen was deposited.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if a woman's uterus tilts forward, typically the cervix points down a little lower in the vagina or a little more towards the woman's back if she's laying on her back. So therefore, the theory was that if the uterus was tilted forward, that really after intercourse, she should lay on her back. And if the uterus, on the other hand, was tilted backward and the cervix is pointed more up anteriorly towards her abdomen or towards her bladder, that after intercourse, she should lay on her stomach or lay on her abdomen for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in theory, that may make sense. I'm not aware of any data that suggests that it's actually a real issue. So.
Right. And it's true that if this were so complicated, it's true that there were not as many people on this earth as there are. I mean, we know this is usually not the big issue in terms of the infertility problem.
Right.
We occasionally do have couples who come and say, well, it seems like there may be ejaculation occurring outside the vagina. And in those scenarios, yes, there may be a legitimate issue with the sperm actually not being deposited in the vagina and able to get up in the cervix and the uterus. But typically, as long as a couple is having relatively frequent intercourse, you know, the way they're having it is generally not the big issue in terms of infertility. Generally speaking, there's something else that needs to be addressed.
Well, the other question that I get all the time is, you know, orgasm. You know, does a woman need to have an orgasm with sex, with trying to conceive? Does it make a difference? Does it not make a difference? And what do you tell your patients?
It's great if it happens, but it's certainly not necessary for fertility reasons. And there is some interesting video footage that's available that shows that, you know.
Wait a minute, what kind of video footage?
Well, somebody put a camera in somebody's vagina during an orgasm, and it was interesting because you can actually see when the uterus contracts up above, you can see the cervix sort of dip down. Yeah. And especially if the male has already ejaculated, you could in theory say, well, gosh, there may be some benefit to this cervix sort of dipping down into the pool of semen.
Kind of scoop up some sperm.
So, yeah. But luckily, the sperm are pretty small and agile. And, you know, as long as there are enough of the good ones, they do a pretty good job of getting into the cervix and the uterus. So, you know, orgasms are great, but it's not necessary technically for the woman for fertility.
Okay, so to dispel that myth, the answer is yes, a guy needs to have an orgasm during sex, but a woman does not. Correct?
Correct.
You'd agree with that?
Correct.
Great.
Unfair, but yes, correct.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it doesn't always have to be the world's greatest experience, but it's nice when it is. All right, so what other questions do we get? I'm trying to go through the list of questions here that we got. That we were handed.
Yeah, but, you know, another thing that I want to talk about is prescription medications and herbal medications, because a lot of times when we say, are you on any kind of medications, people forget about the herbal medications they may be using, and especially in Austin and in Burlington, Vermont, where I came from before here, it is very common for people to be on some sort of like tinctures or herbs or such, and we certainly have a healthy relationship with providers of different modalities of medicine, but we recognize that it's sometimes hard to combine Western and Eastern medicine effectively. We need to know about any kind of herbal medications as well as traditional prescription medications that you're on. Even if you find, even if you think, well, gosh, I'm getting the nature food store, they're totally, quote, natural, there can't be any possible interaction. We actually have had patients who've had, you know, not adverse, but like a irregular treatment outcomes.
Right.
Because they were on medications that we were prescribing that were interfering with herbal medications they were on.
Right. Or thinning of the uterine lining. I mean, that can certainly happen.
Right.
We know that irregular bleeding can certainly happen. Some, you know, some herbal medications that you might not think of as being problematic can occasionally adversely affect some of the hormonal fluctuations that we're trying to influence.
Right.
So some of the things that we're trying to cause by giving medications to try and correct ovulatory problems can actually be interfered with.
Right. I've had people, you know, on progesterone creams like throughout the month or estrogen creams. And these are things that actually can act as contraceptive agents, meaning birth control. So it's really important to be very honest with your provider about any kind of prescription or herbal medication or even vitamins you're on. For instance, you know, we know that there are some normal ranges of like vitamin intakes per day as they are provided by the FDA. There are certain vitamins that you can technically overdo it on. For instance, the vitamins A, D, E, and K. And we want to make sure you're not taking too much of that, because if you do get pregnant, especially spontaneously, there could be adverse effects on the pregnancy.
Sure.
And even if you have providers who have prescribed medications for you, you know, like a cardiologist or an OBGYN or internal medicine specialist, it's, you know, it's still important for us to know, just to make sure that there may not be a better alternative, or just to make sure there's not a complete contraindication to pregnancy with some of these medications. Because sometimes we can talk to the provider and figure out a better solution.
Well, we'll pick back up on this topic when we come back after the break. But also after the break, I do want to touch on the male history, because, you know, it's so important. I mean, about 40 to 50% of the couples who we see have some or a major component of male fertility. And so we want to talk about, what do we do when the woman's evaluation is normal, and what questions are we going to ask the guys? Because we don't want women out there to think that we're just focusing on them and the guys are getting off scot-free.
Oh, no.
So anyway, again, this is Beyond the Birds and the Bees with the Texas Fertility Center. Our website, www.txfertility.com. If you have any questions, we'd love to talk to you. You're welcome to call in at 390-1370. Again, we're live today in Austin about 1240 on Sunday, Saturday, the 26th of June.
Hey, this is Dr. Natalie Berger here with Dr. Kaylin Silver again. We are again continuing our show, Beyond the Birds and Bees, today, Saturday, the 26th of June, around 1245. We are here for you guys, so if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call at 390-1370. And where we left off before we went to commercial is just talking a little bit more about, again, how history can be important in terms of fertility evaluation and treatment. We're just going to talk a little bit about the female side, and then we're going to segue on to the men. So just a few more things about what's important in your history. Well, you know, any kind of medical diagnoses, you may not feel that they're very important. Just feel free to give us the information so we can deduce whether or not we think it's something relevant to your fertility history. Surgery can actually be fairly important. And the reason that we ask about this is especially in cases of abdominal or pelvic surgery, for instance, C-sections, history of prior fibroid removal cases, appendectomy, specifically when especially it's been a ruptured appendix that's being taken care of, there are certain surgeries that can significantly increase your risk of scar tissue. And not always is this something that you can actually pick up on ultrasound examination or the x-ray dye test. So it really actually is fairly important to know, you know, if you've had any kind of surgeries and especially abdominal or pelvic surgeries in the past. We talked a little bit last time about, you know, how substance abuse, drug use, and even weight loss or weight gain can be relevant to fertility. Occasionally, there are people who have funky, unusual chemical radiation exposures, whether it be like in their occupation or hobbies and stuff. And, you know, if they grew up near Chernobyl or something, or something unusual in terms of chemical radiation exposure, that's something they want to know about. And also to touch a little bit on family history. You know, it's usually doesn't significantly color what we do, but it may change a few things. For instance, if someone comes in and says they have painful periods, they're like, yeah, and my mom and her aunts and like my two older sisters have all had hysterectomies for horrible endometriosis. Well, ding, ding. You know, that's something that really makes us perk up our ears because we do know there can be a familial component to endometriosis.
Sure.
And also like unusual genetic disorders, because we are doing the fertility evaluation, and if there is some kind of concern about a genetic disorder and the family history that may be transmitted, we may have an opportunity to actually look and do this kind of testing on even embryos before they're put into the uterus.
Yeah, that's so true. We actually have a caller who's called in on the line, and that's Diego. Can we pull him up? Oh, Diego, can you hear me? Diego, are you there? Okay, maybe not. Well, anyway, the question, I think we have a question that Diego called in. He says he's had one child before, and now his wife is now he and his wife are having a much more difficult time to conceive. Should he get tested? And this is a great segue because this is what we wanted to talk about next anyway, which is male infertility. So the scenario here is that man and a woman have had a baby before, or actually he's had a baby before in a previous relationship, I guess. And now should he get tested or should his wife just be the one to get tested? And Natalie, how do you approach this? I mean, do you believe in testing both members of a couple, or if you've got a guy who comes in who says, hey, listen, I don't need to be tested. I've already had a kid. You know, I've got proof that I'm fertile.
Absolutely, I would test him. And it's true that the one test that we do in terms of basic testing for men is a semen analysis. And luckily, for a lot of scenarios, men can actually collect at home, and either he or she can bring it in. So it doesn't necessarily have to be this totally like intrusive and totally stressful experience in a laboratory or so. But it is so important to look at semen analysis because it is such a, you know, the sperm count and motility and appearance can play such a big part in terms of fertility. And we know that there is such a large percentage of cases where, you know, either the male factor is the primary problem or if there is a problem with both the sperm and something on the woman's side as well, too.
Sure.
And it's probably in like 30 or 40% of cases. Yes, the fact that he has fathered a child in the past gives us a better chance in general, but there is no question that I would want to do a sperm test.
Sure. Because, I mean, it's such an easy test to do, right?
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, you think about what women have to go through with a fertility evaluation, and it's not a major ordeal, but it's a little bit of an ordeal.
It's more invasive, for sure. It's blood work.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, ultrasound. Yeah.
And HSG.
HSG, which I'm sure if you've had before, you or had friends have, you've heard about.
Maybe not a laparoscopy, and all we're asking a guy to do is to, you know, go in a room and collect a specimen.
Yeah, and he can even do it at home if he lives close enough by. And typically people who live, like, within the hour or so, for instance, in the Austin area, if they can collect at home or find, quote unquote, a, you know, separate private area to collect closer to if they live further away, that's all we're asking for. You do not have to collect in the actual laboratory when you drop off the sperm.
Although we do have a place in a laboratory where
that's
they
true.
Can collect. It's private. And, you know, we're adults and we treat our patients like adults. We assume that our patients are adults. And so we treat them that way. So if your spouse wants to go in or your partner wants to go in with you when you collect a specimen, that's fine. And, you know, as we tell our patients, anything other than intercourse and withdrawal is fair game. So, you know, anything that you can do, whatever it takes to get that specimen is terrific. In fact, there's actually a study that I've quoted over and over again in the Swedish literature which was actually a fascinating study. And guys understand this intuitively, but when I talk about this with my couples, sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't get it. But they took the exact same guys, and they sent them into an empty room with a cup to collect a specimen in and a bag. And they said, collect a specimen and bring it out to us. And then they evaluated it. They took those exact same guys. They sent them into the exact same room with the same cup, the same bag. Now they gave them a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
They took those exact same guys.
Any specific kind of magazine.
Right, not Sports Illustrated, not Field & Stream. So anyway, they took them in there, and they had a magazine. They took the exact same guys, sent them into the exact same room with a cup, the bag, and a video. And then they took the exact same guys, sent them into the same room with a cup and a bag and their partner.
Wow.
And what do you think they found? I mean, it was an incremental increase in the quality of the sperm specimen.
No kidding.
So absolutely no kidding. So the bottom line is that the worst quality specimen was the specimen that was produced by the guy by himself in a room, you know, a sterile room with, you know, no ancillary material. When you gave him a magazine to look at, the specimen got better. When you gave him a video, it got even better. But when his partner went in there with him to collect the specimen got massively better. And it's so funny because when I'm talking to couples about this and I say how we're going to collect the specimen and they ask me a bunch of questions, it's like I'll go through the story with them and you can just watch the guys. And, you know, the light bulb the light bulb just goes on over their head because they get this intuitively. And the women are kind of looking
women
at me like,
necessarily, huh?
No, why is that? I don't
But then they're willing to do
is.
Whatever it takes, really, at that
right.
point. Because, you know, it's so hard, I realize, for a lot of guys to get to that point of getting the specimen, even though women go through the invasive testing. It's
right.
true that there is a very personal, sort of private feeling about this, and it can be really hard for guys. But,
sure. No, it's embarrassing, and it's, you know, something you got to talk about, and you think, okay, what's going to happen? I mean, because everybody watches the movies, right? So
yeah.
you know, you've seen Billy Crystal's movie, Forget Paris, and all these other movies where guys just kind of show up, and they drop off their specimen, and there's a line of 15 guys with their little brown bags ready to drop off a specimen. Everybody's embarrassed, but it doesn't work that way. It's very discreet. It's very professional. Everything that we do there is very professional. But
and I want to mention something else, because sometimes there'll be scenarios where a couple will say, well, I understand the need to look at the sperm. However, the way that you are describing collecting the sperm really does not work for us from a religious or philosophical standpoint. So, and there technically is another alternative as well, too.
Absolutely.
We have what's called a collection condom. So technically, what a couple can do is the man can basically use the condom during intercourse, and the sperm sample can be collected in the condom, which can then be put into the cup and then given to the laboratory.
Right.
Because there are certain religions that are not kosher with the idea of masturbation to collect a specimen, and this provides us a different way to get the sperm to look at.
Right. I mean, you're combining, you know, religion and kosher, but that's I'm not going to take it personally or anything, but the bottom line is that because of religious directives, for example, Catholics, in the Catholic Church, you know, masturbation is proscribed, and so therefore the seminal collection device has a little hole in the tip, and so it is theoretically possible that the couple could conceive mm-hmm. during the collection process, and that's really what I think the religious directive is getting at, and so these seminal collection devices are designed in such a way to fulfill that mission, so to speak, of the Catholic Church, and therefore it totally gets around the problem. But other issues within a guy's history. I mean, what if we're going to talk about the same things as we talk about with women, right? So
right.
we talk about their medical history.
Yeah, and surgical history really comes up when we start talking about maybe hernia repairs or testicular torsion, meaning like testicle basically twists around its blood supply, and that can be an excruciatingly painful condition. Sexually transmitted infections. Any kind of major other trauma to the testicle area, because this can raise the concern for something called anti-sperm antibodies, in which
sure.
case you have perfectly good moving sperm, but they have these little proteins called antibodies stuck onto the heads of the sperm, and this makes it harder for the sperm to attach to and fertilize the egg.
Right, but we can fix that problem. We just have to diagnose it first.
Right, we have to know about it. And it's true that there usually are populations that we tend to say have a higher chance of this being a problem. So if you have certain, you know, surgical history or injury history, yes, it's something additional we would look at, but not necessarily so in a standard person without particular history elements.
Right. And just so the guys understand, I mean, don't expect to come to the office and, you know, expect that we're going to examine you, because we're trained as OBGYNs before we did our fertility fellowships. And so we work very closely with urologists. If we find something abnormal in the semen analysis, we'll probably ask you to repeat it, because there's so much variability from specimen to specimen. We may want to get some blood on you to check your hormone levels to make sure that there's not a simple, easy hormonal problem that we can correct. If those things are evaluated, that we will then probably send you to a urologist. so that you can be evaluated and examined, and we can make sure that there's no mass. You know, a couple of times a year we find testicular cancer, and the presenting symptom is infertility. The guy comes in, he's got a very low sperm count. We send him off to a urologist. The urologist examines him, and lo and behold, they find a mass. Well, I can't believe it, but our show is really almost over here. So I can't thank you enough for joining us today.
And it's been a pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you very much again. Just to recap, we are from the Texas Fertility Center. Our show is called Beyond the Birds and the Bees. We would love to have you contact us. You can contact us at our office at area code 512-451-0149. You can follow what we're doing here by going to talk1370.com. And we would love to have you check out our website, www.txfertility.com. We hope everybody has a terrific weekend, and go out and enjoy the rest of your Saturday. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next Saturday on AM 1370.